Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today I'll be interviewing Kimberly Spencer. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Please make sure to leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. You know, Kimberly, you have been a friend of the show. I've interviewed you before, and I know that you're a high performance coach and trainer. Why do some people seem to self-destruct and others succeed with their lives?
I love this question, Maurice. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And why some people self-destruct and some people succeed really comes down to a decision. Consciously or unconsciously, at some point we decided to give in or to buy into some plagiarized programming. And some of us choose to challenge that plagiarized programming and others choose to not. And so if there is a piece of plagiarized programming, like, let's say you don't believe you're good enough. So if you have bought into a belief, like let's say in childhood, if you didn't get straight A's, then you, your parents, you know, would get upset. And then you created a meaning out of it, a belief that meant that if you weren't achieving at a certain level, then you weren't good enough. And so it created this root belief of not being good enough. And that is what I call plagiarized programming. And some of us buy into that. And so when we buy into those beliefs, meaning we accept them as true, then when we achieve something or when we don't, then that suddenly hits on that core root belief. So it always comes back to what is it that we are choosing? What is the story that we are telling ourselves about ourselves? Because the story that you are telling yourself about yourself is the one you are listening to every single day, day in and day out, 24/7, as I said in my TED Talk. And that story is typically the one that is most unconsciously decided upon. So out of a pattern of self-sabotage and self-destructing, it first starts with becoming aware of what is the story that we're telling ourselves as to why we're not where we want to be yet.
So does this story tend to happen early on in life, this plagiarized programming?
So what neuroscience has told us based on studies is that I think it's 90% of our programming is done in the imprint period, which is from in utero to 6 years of age, when we are just giant unconscious sponges experiencing the world and having no real way of filtering it. So that's when a lot of our programming takes place. And when we see how to survive in the world, our brains are wired to survive, not necessarily to thrive. And so when we see patterns, maybe from our parents or from our caregivers that maybe aren't healthy, but at least that's how they're surviving. To give you an example, my dad was an addict. And so I constantly saw this changing of personality, this waiting for the other shoe to drop, this programming of like, oh, he's sober now, but what's he going to be when he gets home? And waiting and having that almost that vigilant watchfulness, which taught me and to not trust not only my dad, but circumstances, life. It taught me to not trust. And that was a belief system that I bought into because of the programming that I was raised in. And so because of that, we can look at those experiences from childhood and examine and question, like, are those ultimately true? Are those stories that we're telling ourselves ultimately true? Or are those stories that we picked up from our parents or from our peers or from friends or from movies and TV. Like, we're constantly being exposed to programming all day long. It's our choice as to what stories we choose to buy into and what stories we choose to consciously create for ourselves.
I thought it was fascinating when I found out about how a child is affected in utero, because I thought you had to be conscious, you know, to be affected by anything, because, you know, working with kids and adults as well, but some kids may have a propensity. They are really anxious from an infant, or they're real aggressive as an infant. And then I trace things back, and sometimes the mother was abused physically or emotionally, or exposed mm-hmm. to certain things, and that programming was passed on to the fetus in utero. So we are, it's fascinating. Our being is fascinating, but once we understand how things work, we can make them work for ourselves if we begin to implement things that will cater to what we want instead of what we don't want.
Mm-hmm. 100%. To give you an example of programming in utero, I was working with a client on through using timeline therapy, which is a combination of neuro-linguistic programming and hypnosis, in order to work through the negative emotions. And so we'd work through anger, sadness, fear, and we were on to guilt. And in his session, he suddenly started to see these very vivid images of a motorcycle and his mom. And he was like, he was able to release the guilt and let go of the guilt. But after his session, he was like, that was so powerful. He's like, I clearly saw my mom riding a motorcycle. And I was like, ask her. And so he went home that evening and he called his mom. And he said, Mom, did something happen? Because in timeline therapy, one of the questions that we always ask as you're leading into the hypnosis of like, when did this happen? When did this experience happen? Was it before, during, or after your birth? And he had specifically said before. And I said, was it in utero or before? Because we can get into generational trauma in a hot second. And he said in utero. And I said, about how old were you? And he said 4 months. And I said, okay. And so then he was getting this very vivid image of his mom. And so he went home and he called his mom, and he said, Mom, did something happen around, you know, when you were pregnant with me around 4 months with like a motorcycle? And she literally stopped and he heard this giant pause. And she said, how did you know? And it had been this secret that she had felt so guilty about. She'd never ridden a motorcycle since. She had gotten into a motorcycle accident when she was 4 months pregnant with her son. Mm. And that guilt was biologically imprinted in him, in his subconscious. The same is true with generational trauma. That there was a study done with cherry blossoms and mice. And this one mouse was exposed to the scent of a cherry blossom. And anytime they would expose the mouse to the cherry blossom, he would receive an electric shock. And then they bred that mouse and they bred him two times, so two generations. And for two generations, even though the mice were not, the son mouse and the grandson mouse were not exposed to the electric shock, anytime they would smell the scent of cherry blossoms, they would have the hormonal triggers of anxiety and cortisol release. And that just goes to show, like, what happened to our grandparents? And that was only as far as they've bred them, but some like in the Bible and religious texts, it says seven generations.
Yes.
And so if we think back to what happened seven generations ago, that still is impacting how our subconscious mind is making these decisions, because it's all unconscious programming. And your subconscious mind loves you and wants to protect you. So it will prevent you from seeing programming that you're not yet emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually ready to release yet. It will repress and memories that you aren't yet ready for. And so the beautiful part is, though, when you start doing your own healing, awakening to your subconscious mind, awakening and asking new questions, becoming aware of your patterns, it also allows for greater generational healing. And there's a ripple effect with that, too.
It gives understanding and more clarity as well to slavery. I'm not going to stay on this, but slavery in people who have endured so much trauma and horrid things throughout the years, and the kids, the grandkids, and you know, all these generations past that, is a ripple effect that's playing a part into the behaviors that people don't understand why they do certain things. And the thinking, the thought process of lack, the thought process mm-hmm. of responding violently, or, you know, all these different things, because we are so beautiful in the way we were made, so perfect in the way we were made. But just like that happened, and have one person in the line that could change things as well, began to reprogram their subconscious mind, and that could cause a ripple effect on generations to come also.
100%. And the same is true with the people who were the abusers, the people yes. who were slave owners as well. Like, we also, like, considering that, you know, set however many generations ago, 7 generations ago or whatnot, that the people who were so desensitized to humanities and to seeing humanity suffering, and that generationally we can reprogram that desensitization, but it starts with us being allowing for us to look at ourselves and hold space to have a conversation that makes us uncomfortable, hold space to have a conversation where we may feel shame and guilt, not because we did anything in this lifetime, but generations past may have. And being able to understand that trauma response from both parties and hold space in order to create that greater healing.
Now, you said moments ago about, you talked about your dad being an addict. Mm-hmm. And you told yourself a story because you interpret his erratic behavior, the up and down. He would change, you know, depending on what was going on, the mood. And you began to tell yourself this story, and this story was imprinted on your subconscious mind, and you began to respond that caused negative things to happen in your life, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one of the biggest experiences was my 10-year battle with bulimia. So I was literally modeling what I saw my dad do with addiction, which was anytime he would feel a big emotion, because my dad was one, like, when he was sober, he was an amazing, generous man, and he had a huge heart. But his generation and his upbringing was very much be the strong man, don't be a wimp, and all that type of plagiarized programming that didn't really allow for someone with a big emotions and big feelings to express them. And so he was taught from a very young age that emotions were manipulative and they should be repressed and suppressed. And so he would repress and suppress his emotions with alcohol and drugs. And that was the tool that was permissible for men to use. And so that it's a crappy tool, but it was the only tool available. So, like, it's just like if you're trying to fix a car and all the only tool you have is a hammer, you're going to start swinging away at things. You'll probably do some damage, but eventually you'll hit something that may, you know, kick the pistons into gear, and it may work for a while. But that experience of seeing him repress and suppress his emotions, and the cycles of him going through periods where he would want to get sober. And so he would in those cycles where he would try to get sober, he would shift his focus onto a new addiction, which typically was his body. And at the same time, I would watch my mom, a codependent, who never said a nice thing about her body. She still to this day, I have to remind her, I'm like, Mom, say something kind about yourself. But she would always compare herself. And there was this very, talk about societal programming and generational conditioning with patriarchal standards of you're beautiful in your 20s and 30s, but once you hit 40, once you have kids, once you hit 50, once you go gray, no longer beautiful. So she had this patriarchal generational programming that she only considered herself beautiful in her 20s and 30s because that's what the traditional American society that she had grown up in taught her. And so because of that, I learned some very crappy resources for how to think and feel about my body and how to deal with emotions. And so I modeled that same behavior, that same suppression behavior through bulimia. I mean, if you think about what bulimia is, I would consume a whole bunch of food. So I would shove a whole bunch of things down my throat, shoving emotions, shoving stories, shoving actual food. The food was just the physical. Everything else was the stuff I was, the emotional stuff was what I was really shoving down my throat. And then it would become too big, too much, feels too full, and I would vomit it up. Well, the same was true with emotions. It would become too big, too full, and I would spew or burst out in anger or burst out in frustration at myself, at my body, at others, and I was very, very reactionary. And it took some time to reprogram that because that was my conditioning. My conditioning was growing up, suppressing, repressing, and trying to escape from, and then suddenly allowing it to explode just enough so that you feel better momentarily. But that's a feeling that doesn't last because you haven't dealt with the root cause, which is the negative emotions that are present and the trauma and the stories that you're telling yourself. And so that through my own healing, I was able to then help my dad guide him through some tough love into his own sobriety from alcohol to where he passed away this January, but he was so proud of himself. Just 3 weeks before he died, he proudly declared, "Kimmy, I am 4 years sober," and he was so proud. And he still would say to this day that that intervention that I staged for him changed his life.
I'm sorry to hear about your dad early this year. That wasn't very long ago. How did he turn on his body? How did he cause his body or view his body in a negative way?
So I think with any addiction and a lot of societal conditioning, we're taught not to trust our bodies and our body. Like we're taught that from the neck up, everything is good. Logic is very praised. But anything from the neck down, the body, the heart, the being in it was something to not be trusted. And I understand it because my dad too faced multiple forms of abuse as a child, and his mom before that, and possibly before that as well. But the experience of not trusting your body is so how that would manifest for him would be when he would want to get sober, he would suddenly go on a diet or he would go on a fast, and it would be like a 40-day fast where he wouldn't eat anything except for like one thing, like split pea soup or just apples. And that would be how he would try to control his own recovery, which was just another addiction. And so that experience, he was taught not to trust his body. And that's one of the top things that I see with any client who has had past trauma is they have to relearn how to trust their intuition. They have to relearn how to trust themselves because they've been taught or programmed that they're not safe. Their decision-making isn't safe. They don't make safe choices. And so those beliefs, those are all beliefs that we then get to as adults question and challenge, are those ultimately true? And it's our job in the healing process to build that relationship of trust again. I like to say that specifically with your body is, it's the one relationship that divorces actual death. So you might want to start making friends with your body, but the relationship that you have with your decision-making, the relationship that you have with your intuition, the relationship that you have with money, the relationship that you have with your business, everything in life is a relationship. And if we look at those relationships and were perhaps to personify those relationships, how would those relationships look? Would they be a narcissistic, abusive relationship? Or would it be a relationship where you're trying to control and force somebody to do things that they don't want to do? And that was the relationship that I had with my body. It was a relationship where I would try to beat it into submission with 4-hour-long workouts. And I would try to control it by only eating so much because I didn't trust it to produce results. I would try to force it into another I would literally force it to throw up because I didn't trust my body to produce the results that divinely it can, if we just allow it to build that relationship of trust. But because there was no trusting relationship, I was very abusive to my body, and as was my dad. And it took a while for me to heal that abusive relationship that I had with myself so that I could really be able to cultivate a relationship of trust and understanding and now deep love and reverence for my body. My body has now birthed 2 beautiful babies naturally with no drugs and easily and effortlessly, my gosh, with the second one. So that it's, I know that my body, when I lean into a decision, it will respond, but that's because I've spent the past 15 years building up trust with it.
So you really hated yourself, you turned internally, and you had it on both sides. Your mom had a negative interaction with beauty and body image, and your dad, what he was doing. How old was he when he passed?
My dad was 73. He was 73. He would have been 74 in February.
So what made you or what inspired you to stage an intervention for him when he was like 69, 70?
Yeah. What inspired me was I had suspected that he was drinking for a while. And I had grown up with my mom in a very familiar gaslighting situation of no, that's not really happening. No, he's just sick. No, he just took some echinacea spray that smells like alcohol, but that's really not alcohol. No, he just brushed his teeth. No, he's smoking again. That's why he's drinking the Listerine. And so all of these excuses, but meanwhile, my gut was saying something is wrong. Something is off. And I was totally being told that that wasn't the case, that I was wrong, that I just needed to trust him. And I was like, well, I don't really have a long history of trust with him. So I'm going to say no. And I constantly, I believe that we're blessed with the children that we're meant to have in order to guide us to remembering who we are. And I think I was blessed to my parents to challenge them and to allow them to see that feeling big feelings is not a bad thing. And so because of that, I would challenge. And there was one night when my dad came home and we thought for sure he was having a stroke. I was over at my parents' house and I was hanging out with my sister from another mister who was, I call her my sister, but that's only because she lived in the same house as me. And my parents kind of adopted her later on in life. She was 40 and needed a place to stay. And we just gave her my old bedroom and she's family. And so I was hanging out with her and my dad came home and he was off. And he was like, I'm just going to go to bed. I don't feel good. And then he woke up and we thought he was having a stroke. We literally thought he was dying. He was saying things to me like it was his last, last words. And I said, screw this. We're taking you to the hospital. I put him in my car and I drove him to the hospital. And my cranial sacral therapist, who had done work on both me and my dad for the past 10 years, I called her because I think he was supposed to have an appointment with her, or I called her to pray for my dad because we thought he was dying. And she said she had an intuitive hit that she said, Kim, just get him tested for alcohol. And I was like, huh, okay. And that seemed totally aligned for me. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, we're going to get him tested for alcohol. And my mom's like, that's crazy. It's not going to show anything. And it came back, and even 6 hours after he had driven home, he was still three times over the legal limit. And that was when I looked at my mom. I remember standing in the hospital. My dad still wasn't cognizant of where he was, or why he was there. And I looked at her and I walked out. I said, I'm done. And it was within those next 2 weeks that I said, I will no longer have a relationship with, I was done with the gaslighting. I was done with being told that what I felt, thought, and knew in my gut and in my soul was wrong, that something was off. I was done with being told that I wasn't, that what I was feeling wasn't true. I was done with the behavior from my dad. I was done with the drinking. Alcohol, my dad always knew. Alcohol was the one substance that he had been incredibly abusive with in every way. And that was the one substance he could, opioid pills. I didn't like him taking them. He was very manic on them, but he was manageable. He wasn't abusive. Pot, I could care less. He was just stoned and would be laid back. But alcohol, he was not a kind person to be around. And that was my line, and that was my boundary. And so I said, okay. I said, I'm done. I said, I created a whole list of rehab homes, halfway homes, counselors who were faith-based counselors, because both my parents are fundamentalist Christians. And I said, look, I said, here are all the programs for you. Here's all the resources. I've done all the research. Here's the intervention. Here's my boundary. And I said, this is what's happening, period. I said, I will no longer have a relationship with you if you are drinking. So I was done. And so after that intervention, my dad sought help, but that was of his own accord. And I went about 6 months without communicating with my parents, which was very different, because I'd grown up as an only child with them. And it was very much us three as like a stool. And I knocked the leg off that stool. I was like, this stool is rickety. It's not balancing anymore. I'm no longer a part of this. And I was married too as well. And my husband and I were looking to have kids. And I was like, I'm not going to expose my children to my alcoholic dad. I will never put them in that danger. And so my dad ended up getting sober. In that time and in that space, I found out I was pregnant. And the beautiful part was my son, when he was born, helped so much contribute to the healing, because my dad got to be the sober grandfather that I'd always wanted for my children. Because when he was sober, he was amazing. And seeing him for the last 4 years of his life, being able to step into that role and do it with grace, and not without his fair share of challenges, but to do it to the best of his ability, I was so proud of him. And he was so proud of himself, because he was able to walk through that fire and really kick that habit to a degree. And honestly, I believe that when he passed, it really was his time, because with everything happening with COVID and the lockdowns and all of that, it really challenged his sobriety. And he was feeling very challenged in the last few weeks and months of his life to maintain that. And I honestly think he was done with the struggle. And I feel like death freed us both in many ways.
It's a beautiful story, you know. And I would think, you know, all of the years and year after year, it's so easy to give up, especially on other people who may not be conducting themselves the way we would want them to, you know, doing different things that harm themselves, that break your heart because you want to see them do so well in life. How did that affect your mom in any way, his transformation?
Oh, yeah. they went to codependent relationship and you know, counselors as well. It's good because I told her, I'm not, my dad's not just the one who's going into rehab. You are too, for Codependence Anonymous, because I was done with the gaslighting. Because that's what codependency is you will make excuses for the other person's behavior. And what happened was she stopped mothering him. She stopped being the one who would push him into things, and she just got tired and recognized that she was really kind of done with having to be the gas behind the relationship, but behind, like, getting my dad to go out and do things, because he was a hustler. Like, I mean, a testament to their strength of my dad's character is, even though he was an addict, within 30 years he built a multi-million-dollar business, and he didn't even recognize it because he was just working himself so hard, another coping mechanism of escapism. But he was working himself so hard that it took me actually reflecting that back to him of saying, you realize, Dad, that you've built a multi-million-dollar business in 30 years, and that's with all the struggles that he didn't even acknowledge it, because that's what happens when you train your reticular activating system in your brain to only recognize your failures and your flaws. And that was my dad. He struggled with forgiving himself for some of the things that he had done to me, for some of the things that he had done in his past. And he really struggled with having that self-compassion, because he was training his mind to only see the guilt and shame of the bad things that he did, and versus choosing to accept the fact that things happened, that he made certain choices in his past that, yes, were regrettable. And at the same time, they can be turned into something. And for my mom, she was able to really separate herself, and she's now starting to find herself. I mean, when my dad passed away, she told me she's never lived alone in 73 years of being on the planet. And this is the first time where she is now having an opportunity to get to know herself and what she wants and what she likes, and how to take ownership for her circumstances and for her her choices in a very different way.
So she went from her parents' house to marriage.
She went from her parents' house to college with roommates to marriage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She had to stop in between. Okay.
Yeah. Well, in college was where she met my dad. Yeah. She went from parents' house to living with roommates to living with my dad. So she'd never actually lived alone. And I really do believe, because I went off and lived on my own for a few years, and it was very, very, very healing for me, in order for me to find myself. And the same was true with my husband. When my husband got divorced from his ex-wife, he had 7 years where he was single and living alone. And those 7 years were transformative for him. And I don't think he would have been ready for me had he not had those 7 years of living alone. I highly recommend people, if you can, go live on your own, and not just like live with a roommate, but learn how to live by yourself for a little bit, not for, you know, forever, but how to be with yourself. That's a powerful one, to learn how to be with yourself, to learn how to like yourself enough to want to be around just you.
That's a powerful thing, to learn how to be with just you and your own thoughts. It's freeing once you begin to deal with those different things. And those thoughts, a lot of negative thoughts, people fear themselves often and want to placate themselves with being distracted, music, hanging out with friends, and just fall asleep and then get back up and do it again and become, you know, dependent on things. It's so easy to become dependent on things anyway, especially this day and age where we have so many things at our disposal, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's easy to escape into anything. I mean, you can escape into the metaverse on Facebook. And that's really what I think the metaverse is. It's when your digital life is more important than your physical life. So when I see a family go out to dinner and every single family member is on their phones and no one is communicating, they are trapped in an entirely digital universe where their digital world is more important than their physical, actual reality world. And I think we're at a tipping point in society right now where we need to question, like, what is our digital life worth to us? And what is our real life? What really is the reality that we want to choose to lean into and live in?
Now, you had to go through a transformation yourself. You know, you talked about your upbringing and the things that you were exposed to. Now, when you realized what was going on, was there a straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, with you that caused you to want to change the things that were going on in your life?
There were a few. One was, I mean, I think for every transformation, like, the catalyst is pain. And so I had built up enough time being bulimic and had enough pain, like, recognizing that I wasn't getting any better, to where the big straw for that one was I went to go throw up my food one day and my mom chased me upstairs, pulled me off of the toilet, tackled me to the ground and sat on me and said, "I love you, Kim. I'm not going to let you kill yourself." And that was when I really realized that an eating disorder is a slow form of suicide. And I didn't want to live. I wanted to find a way to live and love my body. And I just had to believe that there had to be a better way. The same is true with the transformation to stage my dad's intervention. Like, that in itself was a gigantic transformation where the catalyst was the pain of seeing him sabotage himself yet again and also put others at risk. Like, the fact that he had driven home, he was three times over the legal limit, 6 hours after he'd driven home, and seen some of my friend's kids on his drive home, because some were like, "Oh, I saw your dad today." And I was like, "Oh my God, he was drunk off his ass. Like, he could have like hurt someone very badly." That was like, no more. But there were always these micro transformations as well that just came from me following my curiosity. So if you had told me that I would teach Pilates for 10 years and be fascinated by the kinesthetics of the human body, I would have thought you were crazy back in high school, because I could have cared less about biology. However, because I attached it to a why, because I found the why of Pilates, it was something that made me feel good. It was something that I could use to serve it. By learning more about the human body and how it worked, I was able to actually help myself in my healing journey by seeing, oh, if I strengthen my external rotators, it pulls my shoulders back, which suddenly allows me, which then sends signals to my brain of being more confident. Like, if you had connected those dots for me, I would have been way more fascinated in school, but I would have had no idea that I would have been a Pilates instructor except for the micro transformation of following my curiosity. The same was true with my micro transformation of leaning into going from screenwriting into building an e-commerce company, because I was surprised that I was only 90% fulfilled when I wrote my first screenplay and saw it produced and distributed. And there it was. I was at the premiere and it was on the big screen. And I was like, why am I only 90% fulfilled? And then I found out 2 weeks later that that film changed a boy's life, and he stopped following the path of the main character and had stopped partying and doing drugs because of that film. And I said, that's what I want to do. I want to transform people's stories. And at the same time, I was presented with an opportunity to come on as a partner in an e-commerce firm and an e-commerce company and a startup. And I was like, yes, maybe this is how I transform people's stories, is through business. And through, if I make a lot of money as an entrepreneur, then I'll be able to transform people's stories by my philanthropy or with this product. And so I was with that company for 2 years. And then that buyout process sparked another transformation, because I never had doubts about myself in my career or as a business owner or as an entrepreneur. I'd always been super audacious with my career. I'd always gone for whatever I wanted to achieve. And through going through that buyout, suddenly all those fears that I'd had with bulimia about not being good enough and having to achieve and having to do more and needing more, you know, needing to lose more weight, suddenly were brought to light by professionals in the form of my career, of that my credentials were not good enough. My age was not good enough. Me being a woman wasn't good enough. Like, all of these perceptions were suddenly brought to light. And so then when I went to start my coaching business, Crown Yourself, for the first year and a half, I didn't make any money because I was so scared of other people's judgments, of rejection, of failure, of doubting myself, thinking that good enough. Maybe I need more credentials. Maybe I need, maybe if it's too sparkly, they won't take me seriously. And all of those funky beliefs that we have, and mine were deep, because they just paralyzed me from taking action. And then it wasn't until I had found out I was pregnant with my son where I had basically a come to Jesus moment where I said, like, I either have to make this work or not, but I know that the person that I had become through that year and a half of not achieving anything in my business and not growing it because of my fear, I knew that that version of me was not who I wanted to be, the parent to my son. And I knew that I wanted to be, I knew that I always wanted to inspire my kids that if I'm going to say that they can, that anything is possible for them, then I better damn well prove it for myself and I better damn well live like it. And so I started to question my story of, like, business being hard and it being impossible to have a successful business and be a mom and all of those beliefs. And again, reprogramming those beliefs and those stories and transforming them into something that now I have a business that I absolutely love and that I absolutely fulfills me and that brings me so
much. Well, I know some people may be listening and they may be skeptical and say, that's Kimberly. She did that, but I don't know if I could do that. She, have this special power that I don't have. You know, my education, the things I've been exposed to, the people I've been exposed to, don't have the insight and gave me the opportunities. Einstein famously said, and I know you've heard this quote, he said, imagination is more important than knowledge. What would you say to the skeptic who is hurting and want to change?
Look at each one of those excuses and find somebody who's doing it. So each one, like, for example, I used to tell myself a story that, it was going to be harder for me to achieve things because I'm a mom. And so I stopped, in order to stop listening to that story, I had to start looking at moms who I admired who were succeeding and thriving in their business and in their relationships. So look at every single one of those stories that you're telling yourself of why you can't do it. Oh, maybe it's because of your health. Oh, it's because of, maybe you had some sexual trauma in your childhood. I had sexual trauma in my childhood. I was raped as an adult. I have been discriminated against as a woman. I am a white woman. So yes, it's very different for me in the terms of race, but go find, an African-American woman or a Native American woman or somebody else who's doing what it is that you want to do, who takes that excuse that you have down. And if you can't find anybody, then that means that you are the exception and you are the pioneer and you are the wayfinder and you are the one who is responsible then to lead future generations. Because for me, the biggest thing that changed me was stepping into the role model mindset, because while I did find other mentors who had similar experiences as I had that challenged my perceptions of what was possible, that allowed me to see that, yes, my excuses were bullshit and that what I wanted was actually possible, and I leaned into that. The other part was I looked at myself from the stance of a role model, because I have two young boys. I want them to see what's possible for women. I want them to see what a strong woman is who holds her boundaries, who's able to achieve her dreams, who's able to provide an amazing life for her family, who is able to lean in and say, if it's possible for me, it's possible for you. And like I said in my TED talk, your life is a testimony for possibility. People are watching your life play out according to that testimony. So they're either watching your life as being a warning for everything that they don't want, or and you are the example for the possibilities that they can achieve. So choosing to lean into your life being the example of what's possible so other people, other generations, other that you can leave the legacy and the impact so that other generations will look to you and say, if she can, I can. And that's one of my favorite statements. It's one of my favorite statements ever that I say anytime I feel the pangs of jealousy or even that hint of, well, she doesn't have kids, so that's probably why she was able to succeed faster. Or, oh, they don't, that he's a man, so that's probably why he was able to achieve this. Anytime I hear my ego come up with those bullshit stories, I immediately say, uh-uh, if she can, I can. If he can, I can too. Because all of us humans are born completely average with the ability to simply poop ourselves, cry when we need help, and barely mechanically move our bodies. And everything else is learned. Learning how to walk is learned. Learning how to build a business is learned. Learning how to lead is learned. Learning how to be productive is learned. Learning how to do anything that you want in your life. Everything, every skill set is learned. And so I look at somebody who's achieved something that I want to achieve, and I say, if she can, I can too, or if he can, I can too. Then I follow that up with a question, what is the skill set that they had to learn that I now need to learn? What is the mindset that they operate by? What are the belief systems that they have that I then need to adopt for myself? This was a huge catalyst for my recovery from bulimia, from 10 years of my battle with bulimia. And it came from me teaching Pilates, because as a Pilates instructor, I was exposed every day to 10 different belief systems from 10 different humans who had found a way to survive in this world, because our brains are wired to survive, not to thrive. And because I was listening and watching these clients of mine, I was listening and hearing different belief systems that they had. And I would test on a belief system like I would test on a pair of clothes. When you try on a brand new pair of jeans, sometimes they don't feel right. Sometimes they feel funky. Sometimes they feel too tight. Sometimes they need to be worn in a little bit. Sometimes they're not your style. But test on a different style of belief. Try it on. Play with it. The worst that can happen is you chuck it, like, just like a pair of clothes. So trying on different belief systems to see how would that work for you. So there was one client that I had in particular. She was a lawyer at a very successful law company. She was coming to me at like 9 o'clock at night when she was pregnant and with her third child. And she would just like walk in super happy, smiling. Like I saw that every day she chose joy. She chose to be grateful. And I asked her, I said, have you always been this way? Like, what was your background growing up? And I was expecting for her to say like that she lived a perfect life and that, you know, nothing went wrong in her life. And she shared a story that literally mirrored my own background. And it was in that moment where I saw, well, what did she figure out that I haven't been able to figure out yet? And that's the thing. If you're hearing me speak or any other person speak on a podcast or on TV or whatever, and you see that they've achieved something that you want to achieve, just know that that skill set is learned. The mindset is also learned. And so you can learn both that skill set and that mindset. And when you ask yourself, what is it that they have figured out that I haven't been able to figure out yet? Keyword being yet. That is how you cultivate a deep sense of trust in your ability to figure it out. You are capable of figuring anything out. It just will take time and it will take practice. And I like to give the example of watching my son learn how to walk for the first time. And I saw him fall so many times, so many times. In fact, scientists say that it takes an infant 10,000 falls before they successfully learn how to walk on two legs. Mm. Isn't that interesting? That's the same Malcolm Gladwell number of 10,000 hours, 10,000 falls before an infant successfully learns how to walk. And so the other part of them learning how to walk is when you see an infant's not questioning or judging themselves that they're a failure if they fall on their bottom. Like they are, if they fall on their butt, they just kind of laugh it off, or sometimes they're stunned, but it really is, their reaction is really based on the parent's reaction. And so, for example, I saw one of my sons was playing with, had a play date, and his friend tripped and fell. His mom, like immediately, I went over because I was closest, and I looked at him and I was like, "Hey, how's it going?" And he was shocked, but I was super calm, and he started to smile. And then he heard his mom's voice, and his mom was freaking out, like, "Oh my God, what happened? He fell outside!" And suddenly he started to cry and mirror her response. And so we are collective learning beings. We learn from connection. We make connections because of our connections. And so the reason a child learns how to walk so easily, even though they fall 10,000 times, is because they surround themselves with people where walking is normal. We see pretty much everybody, even if you grow up in a home where there's disabilities, where, you know, one or two parents are in a wheelchair, you still see pretty much everyone else in society is walking on two legs. And so we don't question the normalcy. We make it seem normal that we're walking on two legs and that's totally fine. And so when we are going for any sort of goal, like I said, finding those role models who have done those things, even who with the excuses that you have, and look at those role models and say, well, if they could do it, I can too. And so finding those role models, like if you're going for your first, you know, if you're going for a seven-figure business, who are those seven-figure role models that you can? Now, I don't mean necessarily going and hanging out with them or spending a whole bunch of money on a mastermind that you may not be ready for, but maybe you listen to their podcast. Maybe you read their books. Maybe you follow them on social media to like learn how they think, learn the skill set that they have acquired, learn the decision-making skill set, learn how they lead, and watch them and model that behavior. And that's for any goal. That's for any goal, even a body goal. Like if you have a body goal that you want to achieve, looking at, okay, well, this person has similar health issues. They have similar experiences. But I love the way their shoulders look. So like what moves could I do that help tone my shoulders to look not exactly like that person, but help my shoulders to look better. So, and I use shoulders as an example because I literally was watching Sex in the City last night, and I saw Sarah Jessica Parker's shoulders, and I was like, dang, she has amazing shoulders. And I was like, I wonder what activities and exercises she does. And I just Googled it. And so I've been practicing those shoulder exercises, but not from a space of lack, from a space of curiosity and excitement to get to tone my shoulders, not from a space of I need to, I'm forced to, I have to, I should look like this, but from I'd like to have better looking shoulders. I like the way Sarah Jessica Parker's shoulders look. I'm going to model her the exercises that she does in order to tone my shoulders so that they look like my shoulders, but just a little bit more toned.
When you were talking, I thought about, you know, the different struggles. It's like, I remember hearing a story by Dr. King, and he said, he talked about a boy and a girl. They were climbing up a mountain one day, and the girl said to the boy, I thought they said that there was a smooth path on the side of this mountain, but all I see is rocks and bumps. And the boy said to the girl, it's the bumps in life that help you climb. So it's how we interpret things that are going on in our lives. You pointed mm-hmm. that out, and how that will dictate how we go about doing something about it, because we have to have this mind transformation as well. And how we determine things, because we can get to anywhere we need to be if we just, there's enough opportunities presently in the present moment, where whatever state that person is in, there's enough opportunity to get to where you need to go or where you desire to go. So I really appreciate you sharing that, you know, sharing those stories, because I know it's extremely impactful. And you mentioned a little about your, I guess, is it a mastermind or is it a group? Or not a group, but it was Crown Yourself?
Yeah, Crown Yourself. We have a Facebook community, and where I have leadership tips and inspiration to really guide people into becoming greater leaders, because I do believe that we are meant to be paving the way for the next generation. I'm very focused right now on legacy, and I'm looking at what is the legacy that I'm going to be leaving my children, because they're going to be left with the world. And if I don't say that I stood up to help people be better so that they have a better world to live in, then that's on me. And so we have our Crown Yourself Facebook group. We have, if what I've spoken about today really resonated with you, you're more than welcome to reach out to me on crownyourself.com and click the button that says work with me. And I'm more than happy to have a conversation about that and to really dive in and explore how can you shift your mindset and your skill set to lead and live in the way that you want to lead and live so that your dreams are coming true right now in present time.
What's your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
Own it. Take ownership. Because when you take ownership of the results that you have in life, and ownership is not a sexy thing at first, like, especially if you're achieving results that you don't like, if you're currently like have a negative bank balance and your body feels like crap and you feel like you have no energy, then I totally get not wanting to own it. Problem is that you will never be able to change if you're shooting yourself. Because what I like to say is, like, when you should yourself, you're not even in the race. When you own the fact that you're at the starting line and that you aren't at mile 25, then you know where to start. So you can start asking yourself better questions. You can start questioning. Once you own where you are in your race, once you own where you are, then you can start questioning, how can I get to where I want to be faster? When you're shooting yourself about where you think you should be, or that you should have these results, or that you could have these results if you did this, that, and whatever, when you're should, coulding, and woulding yourself, you're looking at the race from a bystander's perspective. You're looking at your life from a bystander's perspective, rather than really leaning in and owning who it is that you are and what it is that you are here to create and where you are, so that you can move to that next mile, so that you can move to that next level as fast as possible.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.